Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded on November 29th, 2010. Episode 44, 3D Audio. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek of the week is Alan Kramer, CTO of SRS Labs, and a previous guest on the show who's here today in his role as the president of the newly formed 3D Audio Alliance to talk about a new way to conceive and create recorded audio. Hey, Alan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back.
Yeah. Those of you who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or signed into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can pose questions for Alan, and I'll pass on as many as I can as we talk about this brand new way of thinking about audio. So, Alan, let's start with the big picture. What is the 3D Audio Alliance, and why is it important to have yet another new audio format?
Well, the 3DAA is really a component of a bigger picture, something that we call MDA, or multidimensional audio. And with some of the research we've been doing at SRS relative to rendering a true multidimensional audio image, not just in the plane like we currently do with surround sound, but projecting depth, projecting height, we realize that there's a tremendous amount of information lost in the current surround sound paradigm, that a lot of things that the content creators would like to do, they can't do. They basically are stuck with a speaker feed model that essentially allows them only to do amplitude panning or intensity panning between speakers. And you also have to have a priori knowledge of how many speakers you're working with in the playback environment. Anything less than that is going to be a mix down or a blind up mix or something like that. So the concept that we came up with is, the thought that we had is that the whole surround sound paradigm, the way we look at it today, is something that's about 70 years old, that really started with speaker feeds with Walt Disney in 1939 with Fantasia.
Which is just coming out now on Blu-ray, and I want to recommend it to everybody because it actually looks great and sounds great. I didn't realize that surround sound went back all that way.
Well, Disney did some amazing innovation. If you think about it, you barely had stereo back then. In 1939, Disney invented a thing called the pan pot because nobody had done that before. Yeah. All of this electronics that went into these theaters to create surround sound for Fantasia in 1939 were tubes. So the stuff weighed tons, and they'd move them in with giant trucks and install them in the theaters. It was a huge, huge system. But it's interesting to think about it. What we currently do today is the same thing Disney was doing in 1939. We put channels in and we get channels out, and we hang speakers around the room. Mm-hmm. So there's no level of abstraction. There's nothing that's occurred between then and now. I mean, in 1977 with Star Wars, the first Dolby Stereo at the time they called it, and then you moved into the THX certification, so you at least have some baseline performance in the theaters. Surround sound for movie display became more common, but still it was the same paradigm. You put channels in, you get channels out.
And by that, you mean the engineers basically mixed all the various sound elements, which would include dialogue, music, sound effects, and so on. And they had to sort of know ahead of time what the playback system was going to be, how many channels of audio they needed in the final mix, and how many speakers were going to be around the audience, and so on, right?
Exactly. And you think about what they're doing today in production. I was up at one of the post houses in Hollywood last week at Todd AO talking to one of the top mixers. In fact, we were using the new Russell Crowe film the next 3 days. We're using it for testing purposes because he had just finished mixing that project. Mm-hmm. And on a typical film, he's got 300 elements that he starts out with. He's got to push that, squeeze that all down into 5.1. That is a bit limiting, if you know what I mean.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
And that 5.1 is in a plane. It doesn't really consider, especially for 3D presentations, it doesn't consider depth, meaning things moving behind the screen or beyond the screen or towards you from the screen.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't consider height. It's just a very, very simple model. So at the
now
end
we
of
do
the
have,
day,
in terms of height and moving outside of the screen, we do have things like Odyssey, DSX, and Dolby ProLogic 2Z, which I believe has some height channels, but that's all synthesized. There's no real content that's created with those for those channels, right?
Right. Those are all essentially what would be called blind up mixes, where they're making assumptions based on the incoming multi-channel 5.1 or 7.1 audio, and assuming what the content creator intended. And in many cases, they could be a good approximation, but in other cases, they don't really represent what the original intent of the content creator was and what is actually occurring in the visual field.
Mm-hmm.
So, circling back, we said, why constrain the problem to a number of channels? And why even talk about 5.1 or 7.1 or 33.3 or any arbitrary number? Why not record essentially what the content creator was trying to do? Basically, he's trying to place sound objects in particular in space in relation to the listener and in relation to each other. And in mm-hmm. some cases, those objects are moving through space. They may be panning in the flat plane like we're used to, or there may be some desire to have an airplane fly overhead or a dolphin, swimming up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many other possibilities. So there's been a concept in gaming called object-oriented audio, and where objects are rendered in three-dimensional space, usually over headphones, in a game relative to the gameplay in real time. And that's generally contained in one device, and there's an API that the game calls to position those objects, just as it positions objects in the visual field in three-dimensional space, it positions the audio objects.
API is application-specific?
Yeah, application programming interface. So when you write the game, you have to send it XYZ coordinates frame by frame to tell where the audio objects are.
Mm-hmm. And where the visual objects are.
Right, exactly. So why can't we extend that to linear content, to film production? Well, there's a lot of issues with that, having to do with the fact that now you've displaced the creation of the content and the consumption of the content, both physically and temporally. So it may not be, it's not occurring in real time anymore. You have to contain all this information in some kind of a known format so that a rendering device can interpret it at a later date or during a live stream. But a rendering device, a remote rendering device, needs to interpret this information. So we came up with the concept of using these object-oriented ideas, but defining a known transport stream that contains both the audio information and metadata, and that metadata describes the location of the audio objects and the behavior of the audio objects.
Instead of being 5.1, this information would come through and say, this person is located at this place in space, and that train is located in that place in space and moving in this direction and so on.
Exactly. And that we don't care about how many speakers are in the rendering environment. Mm. So conceptually, you can receive one of these streams that describes all this information, that all this information is encapsulated in. And you also, there's another important piece of information, which is the environment discovery. How many speakers do you have? Where are they located? Are you using a combination of physical speakers and psychoacoustic techniques? Is it a 300-speaker theater or is it a one-speaker cell phone?
Right.
But basically, those are two extremes, right? But obviously, any kind of home theater configuration would be in the middle of that, or two speaker TV would be in that range,
or a sound bar with what you call front rendered surround.
Exactly. But instead of now making assumptions about what was intended, this metadata that's contained in the audio object stream can be interpreted by the renderer and then mapped into these environments in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. So that given that the renderer knows what resources it has available, it can take the metadata and say, I know that I have 300 speakers in a theater, or I know I have two speakers in a TV, or I know I have an 11.2 system at someone's home. And it can dynamically map the information in the stream to those either physical or virtual resources.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And that's based on local knowledge of the playback environment. When another weakness of the current paradigm is when you mix a film or even music during the mix down, during the recording process, or you mix it on a dub stage for a film, you basically assume that everybody's going to have a setup like your dub stage. And that's just not the case.
Right.
You have no way of knowing. You have no way of getting a priori knowledge of what somebody has in their house or in their theater or in any other environment, even on a mobile device. And, of course, we all know content's being delivered to all kinds of devices these days.
Yeah, more so to mobile devices than ever.
Right. So the beauty of this is that if a mobile device, for example, has a surround headphone rendering technology, the renderer can discover that and can take the information that was recorded in the metadata stream and use that to create as accurate a representation of the original intent as possible. That could never be done when you're just simply saying, okay, we're gonna mix everything to 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever it is. But, you know, these days pretty much the standard is 5.1.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do that because you were basically mixing to your room, to your dub stage. Now you're just saying what you want the objects to do, how you want them to behave, where you want them to be located, and transmitting that information along down the line so that the rendering device, which is fully aware of the resources available in its environment, can then take that and produce the best possible experience regardless of the playback configuration.
It's incredible. Now, it requires that the playback system, or the rendering system, as we sometimes call it, needs to have some intelligence. It certainly needs to be able to accept this, what you're calling a transport stream, a stream of data, and to be able to interpret it and to say, oh, this is where the sounds are going. This is what I have available to me in terms of resources. And here's how I'm going to render it effectively.
Exactly. And, you know, with the increasing power of the DSPs that are included in AV receivers and Blu-ray players, and even in TVs these days and set-top boxes, that is getting more and more feasible. We'll be able to do that locally and propagate this information as far down the chain as possible. But even given the assumption that the client is too thin and can't do this interpretation, you can also take another approach, which says the database representing the audio and the metadata is on for example, a streaming server or a playout server. And that server can interrogate the device and say, what resources do you have available? And then based on that information, pre-render the audio for the device. So even if the device doesn't have the power to do it locally, it could be done sort of in the cloud. So there's all kinds of concepts here that allow this idea to kind of support all types of playback environments.
Yeah, yeah. That pre-rendering idea is actually a great one for devices, as you say, that are thin, that don't have the processing power to be able to do that in real time. Perhaps the studio could have several different versions pre-rendered. And if you're on a cell phone, it would send you that one. And if you're on a sound bar, it would send you that one or whatever.
Right. And, of course, you know, from a legacy standpoint, it'll be necessary for the studio to, you know, they'll have a reference renderer, and the reference renderer will correspond to their dub stage and where the speakers are located.
Mm-hmm.
They could also punch it. Let's say they have an 11.2 11.1 system, 11.2 system on their dub stage, which most of them don't, by the way. But let's say they do.
Yeah.
That renderer can be configured to render to that, but they could also push a button and say, all right, now render a 5.1 mix out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for devices, for legacy devices, they can't even interpret this stream. They would just load up, you know, take the output of their renderer, the 5.1 output, and that would be put on a traditional, transmission codec like Dolby Digital or DTS or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of opportunities for pre-rendering and for backward compatibility, and we've got a number of concepts in that area.
This is all very important, backward compatibility, obviously, because it'll take a while for this technology to roll out into the marketplace.
Exactly. And, you know, we even have concepts where the objects that we were talking about before could be embedded in a core 5.1 stream, 5.1 bed.
Mm-hmm.
And for devices that can't deal with the object stream or the metadata, you would be exactly the way you are now. But for devices that can, those objects would be extracted out of the 5.1 bed and rendered appropriately in three-dimensional space based on the resources available.
Mm-hmm.
So we've done a lot of thinking about backward compatibility.
But, that's good. I'm very glad to hear that.
One of the things I wanted to get back to is, you know, we talked about right at the outset of the discussion, the 3DAA.
Mm-hmm.
As SRS, we realized that this is too big of a thing to do by yourself. We have to get the buy-in of the industry. We have to get the content producers. We have to get the consumer electronics manufacturers and everybody in between, a lot of the content aggregators and distributors.
Mm-hmm.
And so we formed a completely separate nonprofit corporation called the 3DAA to get these key industry players involved in this process, in the process of, you know, creating this sort of object-oriented sound audio distribution specification, and again, getting away from the traditional speaker feed model.
Right. And have you gotten a bunch of interest from studios and manufacturers and so on?
Absolutely. A lot of interest, a lot of discussion. There's a process by which, you know, there's in any kind of an organization like this, you have an IP policy, intellectual property policy. So we're going through the process now where we have a number of manufacturers and studios and post-production houses reviewing all of those, you know, having the lawyers kind of check everything. But I suspect within a short period of time, we'll actually start to have members coming on board once they get through that initial analysis process.
Sure.
But the idea is to get buy-in and get everybody involved in this, so it's basically meets the needs of the industry from end to end.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other key points here is that this is intended to be an open standard.
Yes, I was going to bring that up, make sure we covered that, because that's really, really important. If anything like this is going to succeed in the marketplace, is to have it be open, royalty-free, I believe, is what your intention?
Yes, as far as that's achievable. I mean, if there's some royalty-bearing things in that are contributed to the standard, we might not be able to avoid that. But the goal is to make it royalty-free so that unlike the current proprietary codecs, where you basically, once you've encoded in those codecs, the manufacturer who incorporates the decoder has to pay a royalty to decode that information.
Mm-hmm.
The intent here would be that the transport stream itself, with the metadata and the audio objects, would be a completely open standard. That anyone can parse that stream and anyone can render that stream as appropriate. And we believe that that creating a competitive environment like that is going to be great for the tools vendors and the studios, in terms of creating some really exciting ways of producing this type of audio.
Mm-hmm.
And also for the consumer and people innovating in ways that, you know, we can't even imagine right now. That's another thing that's beautiful about this idea, is that it's kind of future-proof. Since you essentially wrote down in the stream what the intent of the content creator is, that information can be interpreted in ways that we haven't even imagined yet. You know, people laugh at me, but I said, well, let's say in 50 years they figure out how to put the audio directly into your head with no speakers at all.
Direct neural interface.
Neural interface, yeah. This information in the stream would still be valid and useful as opposed to that's kind of a not a really good use of a neural interface to just limit it to 5.1. So, I mean, it's an extreme example, but I think you understand what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Another analogy to this is back in the early 80s, the musical instrument manufacturers got together and said, essentially, they said, let's do the same thing. They created a standard called MIDI, Musical Instrument Digital Interface.
Yep, I know it well.
And as you know, that's been a huge, huge success.
It's 30 years now, really, and it's still going strong. It's still being
still
used.
Going. Yeah, you may
and,
be getting
and the,
it
key, the key point, I think, if I may, is that all these manufacturers who were otherwise competitors and wanted to keep all their trade secrets from each other decided to send all of their technical guys, their engineers, into a room together and said, cooperate. Build us this language, really, this computer language, digital language that describes musical performances, what notes are being played, how long they last, how loud they are, and all that kind of stuff, independent of any particular product, so that we can all use it together. And as a result, MIDI was born, and here we are 30 years later. It's still going strong.
And all of those manufacturers did very well with that. They even though it was a completely open standard and non-royalty bearing, they all were very successful. A lot of money was made off of MIDI-based devices and continues to be today.
That's right. We have several questions in the chat room, one of which is, what kind of bandwidth is required for this transport stream, and how does it compare to the bandwidth that is currently used for 5.1 audio?
Well, that depends on the number of objects transmitted and also the bitrate reduction, the codec. The concept of this stream is codec agnostic. Mm-hmm. So that basically, on one extreme, you could take what's called a mezzanine file right out of the production facility that has, you know, a large number of objects, audio objects, and a large number of metadata. Now, the interesting thing is when you really think about the metadata, and we've done a little bit of analysis on this, that's actually minuscule compared to the audio data.
Sure.
So it's the number of audio objects that really drives the bandwidth. And unlike a channel-based paradigm, the objects appear and disappear as needed. So you don't have to have a channel there all the time if an airplane only exists in one scene, for example.
Sure. So the bandwidth is kind of dynamically allocated.
Yeah, it's dynamically allocated based on the requirements of the scene. Now, obviously, if you're doing D-Cinema and you're playing this stuff right off a hard drive, you've got a tremendous amount of bandwidth and you don't have to really worry about it. If you're packaging it for streaming, that could change. And you may have some limitations. So one of the concepts we've incorporated is the concept of object priority, where the content creator says, well, this object is like number one priority, really important. It's called the dialogue.
That's kind of important.
Yeah, and maybe the music and maybe this, but maybe a little bird tweeting in the background or flying around your ear isn't really critical if you have limited bandwidth. So you can actually have a situation where you're looking at the audio objects dynamically, determining what your bandwidth resources are, and then determining how much data you want to push down that pipe. So it can be highly variable, but the audio can also be compressed with, you know, traditional codecs like AAC or Dolby Digital or DTS.
Or even MP3.
Or MP3 or AUG, you know, or Vorbis.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of possibilities there. And you know, we live in a, unlike when Dolby Digital first came out, we lived in a sort of a hardware world where everything had to be pushed into a DSP and taxed it to within an inch of its life. We're living in a more of a software kind of world now where we can send down updates to Blu-ray players and to AV receivers, and we can send the codecs down that are needed, and especially with PCs, we can send down what's needed to get the job done rather than casting everything in concrete. So there's a lot of possibilities there, and of course this is going to take a few years to make this happen, and as those years go by, the capabilities are going to become even greater, so it should intersect very nicely with the resources available in these devices. Mm-hmm. And the bandwidth available. I mean, On the East Coast now, for example, with cable, they have DOCSIS 3 where people are getting 100 megabits down to their home. And that's just going to keep going in that direction. So while bandwidth is a concern, I think there's enough flexibility in this concept that bandwidth can be addressed, you know, on a case-by-case basis.
Before we continue, and I know there's a lot more to talk about, I would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or blog, and it's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. There are hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of the designs to fit your needs. Squarespace all-inclusive service includes several modules to build your website, including a blog module, a forum, form builder, Flickr photo display, a Twitter widget, Google Maps, and more. There's website tracking and a built-in search engine optimizer, permission access handling, cloud architecture, an innovative drag-and-drop Ajax interface, and even an iPhone app, which lets you log into your website and update it on the go. Use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, and update it anytime and anywhere. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. No credit card needed. Just try it out to build your own website. Then, if you decide to purchase, use the offer code HTG and get a 10% discount off the lifetime of your new account. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. So, Alan, we've got a couple more questions here. One of them is, here's a question that actually intersects and goes to something that SRS is working on, I know, and we may or may not want to talk about it here, but I'll ask you, and you can say whether or not, which is, how does the sound of someone walking behind a character or in front of a character, how do you do that? How do you put depth into this paradigm?
Well, that's a good question, and that is something that we've been doing quite a bit of work on. In fact, the initial work we did on that kind of led us to the concept that we don't have enough information in the current 5.1 surround paradigm to tell us exactly how to do it and what to do. So we have developed those some, and you heard it, Scott.
I did, and I was very impressed.
So we don't. I don't know how much we want to go into that on this show. I think maybe we'll do that. We'll cover that a little later. But we have developed some techniques that do project depth towards you. One of the problems with the current surround paradigm is that you couldn't even think about projecting depth because you can't put a speaker in somebody's face that's sitting in the middle of the room. But if you do it without a speaker, we've done a lot of study, especially in the last year or so, on how people perceive depth with audio. And what does it mean when a sound source comes closer to somebody or moves farther away? Mm-hmm. That's half the problem. That part of the problem, if you solve that, and we believe we at least have an initial solution to that, and again, it may not be the ultimate solution. If you solve that and you have this sort of 3D AA stream telling you what to do, you've got the problem solved. But unfortunately, right now, we don't have a 3D AA stream, so we've worked on another part of the problem, which is to look at the audio stream itself and make some implications about what we believe was originally intended in the mix. Mm-hmm. This is not simple stuff to do.
No.
And is not always going to be 100% accurate to picture. But because we don't have the explicit information that will be ultimately contained in the 3D AA type stream, but it still serves to demonstrate from a proof of concept standpoint and to to most listeners, it does create a pretty good impression. But once we go beyond that with the object-oriented approach, it will be, you know, really spectacular.
Now, this depth information or the depth idea of putting objects, sound objects, into the Z plane, if you will, the depth plane, is certainly going to be more and more important as 3D movies become more and more common, as they are already, because as you have now visual objects coming in from the screen and going out behind the screen, the sound is going to need to follow them as well.
That's right. And if you think about our current you know, the current configuration that we think of for surround sound, the ITU configuration or whatever, what are you surrounding? You're not surrounding the picture. You're surrounding the room.
Right.
And now you've got things going into the screen and coming out of the screen, and you're not covering those cases. So this depth thing becomes much more and more important. That's why we're doing a lot of research on it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, I mentioned to you when I visited with you a few weeks ago, this sort of interim version will be start to become available in products next year. And as I said, we believe it's quite effective, and you heard it as well. But we also believe that we can go well beyond that once we get the information in the stream.
And, right. Now, that depth technology, that's an SRS technology, right? That's something that you guys are developing at SRS.
Exactly. And that kind of is a good illustration of the delineation between the 3DAA creating this open standard to provide the information and the opportunities for companies to compete and add value by interpreting the information. And that's what we intend to do as SRS, is to apply this research, apply it to products, and then interpret the 3DAA information in a way that we think will add a lot of value and really enhance the consumer experience. And there'll be other companies that do that too. You mentioned Odyssey. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a company like Odyssey would be very happy to parse a 3DAA stream and try to apply it to their 11.1 system rather than trying to figure things out on their own, for example.
Right, exactly. So, like DSS, as you said earlier, assumes that this piece of sound needs to go into the height channel, or that piece of sound needs to go into the width channel. Now they will have the information with this 3DAA stream that they don't have to assume. They know where each piece of sound needs to go.
Right, and we're comfortable with that. We're comfortable that we will be competitive, and if they're competitive, and we're all out there interpreting the stream. The people that are going to really benefit are the companies that do it successfully, but also the consumers, because we're going to create kind of an open marketplace for people to get in there, create all kinds of solutions that we can't even imagine right now. But the nice thing is we will have captured enough data so that we're not constrained by any arbitrary configuration. So people are free to just let their minds go and create anything they can think of. I mean, even to that crazy extreme of putting it directly into your head. and still the information will be there and will be usable. So we won't, you know, I kind of like it on a simpler basis, going back again to 1939, where some of the best films ever made in that year, one of them was The Wizard of Oz. One of the reasons The Wizard of Oz looks so good on new transfers like Blu-ray is that they didn't shoot it in color. They shot it in black and white separations. So they stored the information about the color, not the color itself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, however many, you know, 70 years later, we can take that information and render it using the best techniques available today.
And it looks fabulous on Blu-ray, no question.
Yeah, and it's basically the same concept. Keep the information about the audio. Keep the information about what the audio is supposed to do and how it's supposed to behave. And then people are free to innovate in terms of how to put it into a studio. I paid a visit to last week to a company called Iosono. I assume you've heard of them?
Yes, I have. In fact, I've written about them. And tell us about that. That's another fascinating... now, this is a rendering concept, but it's really beautiful.
So this is another illustration of saying, you know, SRS isn't the only one in this rendering game. they have a system called wave field synthesis. It uses a lot of speakers. The system I heard, again, was at Stage 2 on Todd AO that uses, I think, 224 speakers. Mm-hmm. Don't quote me. I think that's the number.
It's certainly in the hundreds, and they ring the entire theater with these speakers.
Right. They ring the whole theater, even behind the screen. And now they've a new innovation. They've actually, because of making sure the dialogue is easily audible and very specifically located, they've put some horn-loaded speakers behind the screen.
Oh, that's a new innovation since last I heard. Yeah.
Right. So it goes around the whole room. And what it does is it synthesizes the wavefront. So that, for example, if a water droplet was to occur in a particular place in the room, you wouldn't just hear the sound of that droplet coming out of, you know, intensity pan between speakers. They would actually propagate the wavefront of that water droplet or of that sound throughout the room to duplicate what you would hear if the audio source was actually in the room with you. And it can create some pretty impressive effects.
They certainly have a great depth rendering. I did hear a demo of that where things did appear to be right there in the middle of the room.
Right. I actually heard demos where I could hear objects in the middle of the room and I could walk around and still hear them in the same place.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Obviously a very complex and very expensive system, but could be appropriate for theaters or could be appropriate for large-scale venues like theme parks and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The good news is the information that would be contained in a 3D AA stream, they could interpret that and use that information to tell their system what to do in a way, you know, that's just not possible today. The only way you can drive an IOSONO system right now is to mix specifically for IOSONO. And up until now, that hasn't been done except for these demonstrations that you and I heard.
Right.
So the idea would be
that
now we have
a
standard. Now we, with the 3DAA concept, we'd have a standard format that everybody could mix to, that everybody could create it, and it could be interpreted by everything from IOSONO with all of those speakers and wave field synthesis. Down to the simplest type of consumer device.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One question in the chat room is this analogous to OpenGL for video? I'm not a video guy, so, I mean, in terms of recording video, I don't know if you are either.
No, but I'm aware of OpenGL. OpenGL is a standardized open graphics language. There's also a thing called OpenSL, which is for sound. Which actually in another part of SRS we're participating. One of our people in our mobile group is the spec editor for OpenSL. But the concept here is a standardized way of addressing video and OpenGL video and video objects in the device. So in a way it's analogous, but the difference is none of these types of things have contemplated separating the source at the rendering in time and in space. So when you write a video program, a game or something to OpenGL, it's running on the same device as the OpenGL engine. So there's all of the protocols necessary to actually create a transport stream and actually move this from one place to the other or store it on something are not considered because it's actually occurring right on the same device. But other than that, yeah, it's somewhat analogous to OpenGL. If we could imagine sort of describing those video objects and putting that information down someplace and then playing that back through an OpenGL system at a later time or in a different location.
Before we run out of time, I do want to spend a couple minutes talking about the advanced rendering lab that you have built at SRS to help you with some of this development. And I know we have two pictures, I think, that John can post here, put up on the video stream, hopefully. One is called SRS ARL, Advanced Rendering Lab, which I visited a couple weeks ago and found very fascinating because it's basically a room within a room. Here it is. If you can keep that up for a second, John. Alan, why don't you describe this a little bit for us?
Yeah, we spent the first 6 months of this year, or a little more actually, designing and building this lab, essentially considering this whole idea of what we wanted to do as an organization to research a lot of the things we've been talking about, but also how we could research some of the things that we needed for the 3DAA concept. And essentially, it's a room with a 22.2 system, if you want to refer to it in conventional terms. Mm-hmm. All the speakers are powered speakers, so they have individual amplifiers. All the speakers can be moved around in the room so that we can duplicate virtually any speaker configuration all the way up again to 22.2.
I think you had all that rigging was created by a movie set rigging company, right?
Yes, yes, yes. They build it, custom built it for us, and we can wheel things back and forth and take speakers off brackets and move them around and basically create anything we want. But generally, from a practical standpoint, we have enough speakers in there to create an ITU configuration or an Odyssey configuration or anything that's normally in use. And the beauty of it is it's completely software driven, so that we can instantly reconfigure from one thing to another. That allows us to compare different approaches. For example, right, maybe a site. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say the other picture we have is of the equipment rack in that room. Which is actually kind of funny, because the only things in the equipment rack are the computer, which is used to do all the rendering. Here's a picture of it with one of the speakers, and two 24-channel audio interfaces, and that's it. The rest of the rack is empty. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, we maybe didn't need such a big rack. Yeah, but basically that's all it is. There's they're all plus four balanced. Everything goes directly out of the audio interfaces to the speakers. We also bring our inputs in. We obviously have to take inputs from consumer devices. So we level shift the inputs from the consumer devices up to plus four balanced and then run those in. And so the whole room is plus four balanced analog audio, because that's just the most flexible way to do it right now for the variety of things that we have to deal with.
And plus four balance, by the way, just for everybody's understanding, plus four balance refers to the audio level, which is one of two standard levels or amplitudes of audio that are used. Plus four is used primarily in professional applications. Minus 10 is the other one, and that's primarily used in consumer applications. And balanced just means that the wires that are running around the studio are more or less immune from radio frequency interference. If there are stray electromagnetic fields running around, that gets canceled out in a balanced line, which it doesn't in an unbalanced line, just by way of explanation.
Right, and most consumer equipment is minus 10 unbalanced, and it works fine. But when you've got long cable runs and the kinds of things that we're doing in that room, it's better to bring them all up to that higher level of plus 4 dB, and run everything balanced. So that all goes back and forth into those audio interfaces in the rack, and then all the processing and all the configuration of the room is controlled, is done in the PC. And the beauty of that is we can easily switch between any configuration, make direct comparisons, bring in people, do blind tests. I think the example I gave you, John, when you were Scott, when you were down. I switched between our depth rendering prototype and a standard 5.1 system as a baseline of comparison. So our depth rendering system was using two speakers, 2.1, and then we went to a straight 5.1 ITU configuration. But we were able to do that in an instant, just quickly switching back and forth.
It's a wonderful demonstration, and I have to say from my own experience, I found the two-speaker depth rendering system being developed by SRS to actually sound more enveloping, more surrounding than the 5.1 standard surround sound speaker system as you switch back and forth. It was quite astonishing, actually.
I was very excited to hear you say that.
No, as I've described it and as you've described it in the past, the 5.1 system just went boom, it pasted up against the walls. All of a sudden, the entire sound was right there at the walls where the speakers were, whereas the two-speaker depth rendering was actually out in the room. So it was a much more three-dimensional presentation that I'm very excited about. I'm excited about both these things, actually. The 3D AA, which we know isn't going to happen there's not going to be any commercial products available for probably a couple years at least, right?
Right.
And then this depth rendering, which you have said we could see even as early as next year in some products, which I'm also very excited about. And sadly, we've come to the end of our time together. And I know there's probably so much more to say. But I want to thank you, Alan Kramer, so much for being on the show and explaining this new paradigm which we are going to be hearing a lot more about in the coming years. Will we see anything at CES?
We will be having, in fact, I'll invite you right on the, well, I guess this is air or on the internet.
This is the sort of the air, yeah.
We're going to be having a 3DA sort of organization, 3DAA organizational luncheon on Friday of CES. And
oh, great.
We're going to have a mini version of the ARL there.
Fantastic.
Be able to do some of the things we showed you and some additional things that we'll have developed by then.
Excellent.
So it'll be on Friday from 11:30 to 1:30. So just you're automatically invited. We'll send out some printed invitations here in the next couple of days.
Great. That would be great because, of course, my brain is a sieve and my email inbox is my brain. So my memory anyway.
Well, don't worry. I have an almost exactly the same brain. So
yeah, right. So thanks again, Alan. Really appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
You can read more about the 3DAA, the 3D Audio Alliance, at 3daa.org. And Alan's other work at SRS Labs, you can read about at srslabs.com. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be David Reisner, who is one of the developers of the Digital Cinema Initiative, and he knows a lot about digital cinema, so I'm sure looking forward to talking to him. Until then, geek out!